Okay, I think we're ready to start. Hi everyone, my name is Uni Kim and I am a database fellow with the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, and I will be hosting our training call today. So for today, our speaker will be Stephen Lester, who is the science director here at CHEJ. A little bit about Stephen, he has two Masters of Science degrees, one in toxicology from Harvard and another in environmental health from NYU. In addition to that, he served on a variety of advisory and peer review committees, and that includes with the National Resource Council and the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences. For today's training call, he's going to address the strengths and weaknesses of health studies with regards to health issues in your own communities. So this call will basically be ordered so that the speaker, who's Stephen today, will first give his presentation, and then at the end we'll open it up for a general discussion and questions. So first he'll be doing the speaking, and then we'll open it up for everyone to ask a question if they have one. And in addition, you can anticipate a recording of this call to be available for download on our website sometime later today. So if you miss it or if you want to have a downloaded copy of it, it should be available soon. So I'm quickly going to go over some instructions that we'll repeat once Stephen has finished his presentation. So currently only the speakers are unmuted, which would be me and Stephen. If you have questions once he's finished with his presentation, you can unmute yourself by pressing *6. So if you have a question, press *6. And then you can ask your question and we can hear it. And once you've finished asking your question or once you're finished speaking, you can press *6 again to mute yourself. That's just so that we don't get any extra background noise and so it doesn't get confusing. One last thing is that we'll be sending out a very short survey to everyone who's registered for this call, and that will be around 1:20-ish, and that will just be helpful for providing us feedback and to help us keep things in mind as we continue providing training calls. So I think without further ado, I'll pass it on to Stephen.
Thank you, Uni. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I think we can all hear you.
Okay, great. Good. Good afternoon and good morning to some of you not on the East Coast. As Uni said, my name's Steve Lester. I'm the science director here, and this training call today will address the strengths and weaknesses of health studies in the context of what you can learn about health problems in your community. I plan to discuss the benefits and pitfalls of different types of studies, limitations of health study design, the difficulty in interpreting results, and the importance of matching the study design to your community's concerns. I believe you all should have a PowerPoint presentation that was distributed this morning. I'll be using that and as a guide for the presentation. My thought is and plan is to talk for about 25 minutes, and then we'll open up the conversation to Q&A. Some of the slides that I will be using come from and were developed actually by a group at Boston University School of Public Health, who have developed a community guide to health studies that I think would be a great resource for anybody concerned in thinking about doing health studies or trying to figure out what makes sense. I'm going to give you the website for this guide, but we'll also send it to everybody. It's a bit complicated, but briefly, it's www.bu.edu/SPH for School of Public Health /health studies guide with a dash between each word, health studies and guide. But we'll send that to everybody afterwards. It's a great resource. The primary authors of that are Madeline Scammell and Greg Howard, and CHEJ and myself were involved in the development of that that guide and that website, not the website, but the guide itself. So let's get started. The first slide really is a quote from really one of my favorite quotes about health studies. And it says that the definition of a public health disaster or catastrophe actually, is a health effect so powerful that even an epidemiological study could detect it. Now, this statement comes from Dave Ozanoff, who some of you may know. He is semi-retired now and has been involved in assessing health problems in communities for over 30 years. He taught and did his research at School of Public Health, the foundation of that health studies guide. And it speaks volumes to how insensitive most tools are for evaluating health studies. And we'll be addressing that and talking about that quite a bit today. Dave also authored a paper called Truth and Consequences, which is an incredibly insightful article about how public health agencies respond to public health crises. He described public health agencies as being more driven to reassure the public than to tell them the truth. And this is also a resource that we'll share with people after the presentation, after the call is completed. It was written in 1985, but it's just as valid today about how public health agencies respond to crises and what their priorities are. It's a fascinating piece that I think you'll all enjoy reading. So moving on, why a health study? I don't think there's any issue I've worked on during more than 30 years at CHJ that has generated more emotion, passion, anxiety than health studies. Health studies that groups have done themselves or the state or federal government have done. More often than not, health studies leave people feeling frustrated and often angry by a lack of clarity or conclusiveness. Vague or inconclusive is how most turn out. So why do we do health studies? Why do people so desperately want a health study to be done in their community? For most people, the reason is because they want to know the answer to a very simple question. And that question fundamentally is, why am I sick? Or more often, why are my children sick? This question gets asked in a variety of different ways, which are reflected on the next slide. Sometimes it's, have I been exposed to chemical X? Other times is, what major sources of pollution are in my community? Will the proposed trash incinerator be safe for our health and the environment? And there are a variety of other ways that statement gets expressed. So what people want to know is whether they can make a link between the health problems that they're experiencing in their family or they're seeing in their community and some specific exposure. For example, they want to make a link between, maybe they want to make the link between the PCBs in the river and reproductive problems. Maybe it's the PCE in their drinking water and the leukemia they're seeing. Maybe it's living near a waste dump and the birth defects that they see in their neighbors. Maybe it's the industrial emissions and the cancer in their community. There are a variety of adverse health problems that people see and they feel that there's a reason for it and they want to know what it is. In the next slide. And over the years, CHJ has prepared many fact sheets, and we've even got a guidebook on that to help people figure out where studies fit into a group's organizing work. At one point, we actually told people not to bother, only to find out that they did anyway. Some groups wouldn't even call us once they started doing and investigating their health problems because they didn't want to confront us with the fact that they weren't taking our advice, which was perfectly fine. So over the years, we tried to craft resources that help people understand what health studies can tell them and, just as importantly, what they cannot. We've come up with several key questions that people need to ask whenever they're considering asking the government or somebody else, for that matter, to do a health study in their community. These are three key questions. What are you trying to accomplish as a community group? What are your goals? Does the health study help you to achieve those goals? And if so, how does it fit into your organizing work? These questions are about your group and your goals and not about a health study and its goals. That's a whole other set of questions. But in order to figure out whether a health study makes sense, you need to ask these questions to yourself as a community group. Now, on the next slide, we have some of the pluses and minuses of different kinds of health studies. There are many advantages as well as disadvantages to doing a health study. some of the positives that can happen if you do a health study might include the following. You might document disease and or exposure. And you might demonstrate cause between a disease and exposure. These two outcomes, however, rarely occur, and it's largely unrealistic to expect them to occur. More realistic positive outcomes might include educating residents about environmental health outcomes, generating media coverage, and motivating your community. And it might provide valuable political leverage. And it might create an opportunity for members of your community to get involved. On the other hand, some of the negative things that can happen if you do a health study include the following, again, listed on the chart in the slide. You might show that there's actually no problem in your community. And, of course, that would be used against you. You might document that there's no significant relationship to disease and exposure. This, of course, would allow the polluters to continue business as usual or to continue polluting. And you might overwhelm your organizing efforts and sap your members' energy by focusing on just this health studies piece. And lastly, you might generate statistics that might undermine your efforts. So although there's a lot more that can go wrong than can go right in most situations. So the next slide shows you the kinds of health studies that can be done. This slide directly has a couple of these in this current grouping come from the BU folks. There are many different kinds of health studies that can be done. I'm not going to go into any detail and describe these in any shape or form. I just wanted to show this slide because I think it provides some interesting visuals about traditional epidemiological methods, that meaning the case control study, the cohort, or the cross-sectional or ecological studies. These are the classical studies that have been done, had been done. I want to be clear about this, had been done. For most in the past. And these studies are relatively expensive, and they take a great deal of expertise to actually carry out. And they take a lot of time. They're very time-consuming. Other types of health studies include risk assessment and environmental impact studies. They are less time-consuming and expensive, but they too require specific expertise to carry out. The least time-intensive and costly methods include doing a registry, doing a community-based survey, environmental monitoring, or even bodybuilding testing. All of these methods require less specific expertise to carry out. So the next slide gives you a sort of a spectrum of who does health studies. And the spectrum ranges from those studies that are community-driven at one end to expert-driven at the other. In reality, most health studies are not expert-driven. There's very little community involvement. And that takes me to the next slide. I want to talk a little bit about these expert-driven approaches. Because there's been a change in the last, I'd say 5 years or so, maybe it's going into 5, 8, 6, 7, 8 years, but there's a change in how health studies are being done, and that's something I want to talk about. Typically today, the kinds of health studies you see government doing, no matter, and this is largely at the state or federal level, rarely are health studies done at any level below this. And I'm not talking about academic studies. They can be different because they're generally funded differently. But you might see a pilot investigation or a cluster investigation, a comprehensive case review, site-specific surveillance, state-based surveillance, health statistics review, exposure investigation, or disease symptom prevalence. These are all typical studies, all reflected on this chart. Now, you'll note that none of these study types include the standard epidemiological approach. And all of these methods, by the way, would be considered health studies of one kind or another by people who live in impacted communities. So now, I want to pull out two particular types of health study designs that are very expert-driven and very common amongst health agencies, government agencies. And these are the cluster investigation and the health statistics review. So let's talk about the cluster investigation first. CDC, or ATSDR, has developed a guidance on investigating clusters that was originally published in 1990 but updated just a few years ago in 2013. This guidance document lists specific procedures that are followed by all government agencies when investigating a disease cluster. This specific approach, including defining what's normal and expected rates of diseases are, determining observed rates, comparing observed to expected rates, calculating the what's called the odds ratio or the observed to expected ratio, defining the confidence interval for these ratios, and they're looking for a statistic to see if the confidence interval of 1.0 is included. This value of 1.0 is, if the value of 1.0 is included in the confidence range, then this event is not considered to be statistically significant. And in the case of a cluster, no further follow-up is warranted based on that kind of finding. And I want to give you a couple of specific examples of communities where I've been involved, where I've seen this play out, and how it's played out to illustrate what I'm talking about. The first one is from a community in Maryland called Wagner's Point. This example of Wagner's Point is just south of the city of Baltimore. There were 98 families on a peninsula surrounded by 150 industrial and chemical plants. And people there found and felt that there were high rates of cancers everywhere, and they eventually convinced the state to do an investigation. And what the state found was a 50% increase in all cancers and an increase of 2.5 times higher for lung cancer. But yet, when they included the confidence intervals of the study, when they followed this CDC protocol, this ATSCR protocol for how to do disease investigations, cluster investigations, they found that statistically the numbers were not significant. And so that's how this all got reported to the public. This left people feeling frustrated, angry, distrustful of the government and the methods they used to evaluate the cancer risk in the neighborhood. But the real problem here was the lack of disclosure about what this approach could and could not achieve. What the state did not do in Wagner's Point or virtually anywhere else is use a more traditional epidemiological study, case control or a cohort study. And the reason is simple, as I mentioned earlier. It's more time-consuming and expensive. And the big problem here, the reason why they didn't disclose to the public was that the numbers were just too small. The number of families involved, the number of cancers were too small. That you always, whenever you have a small group like this and you're looking at a limited number of outcomes, you're going to get a very wide confidence interval, which goes back to the statistical capacity of this analysis, and you'll almost always see a lack of conclusion here, no matter what the numbers say. So let's talk about the health statistics review. This is the most common approach that I see being used time and time again by government agencies these days. This type of analysis uses available health and demographic information to assess the occurrence of specific health effects in defined geographic areas and determine if the rates are elevated. Available information might include death certificates, birth certificates, tumor or disease registry surveillance data, and all of this is mostly always aggregated by zip code or census tracts. And so fundamentally what this means and refers to is the fact that all of these databases are computer data. All this data is available in computers that are readily available to government agencies. They don't have to go out and go door to door. They don't have to communicate with the public. They can gather their analyses strictly by doing their work at their desk. So, and let me give you an example of this kind of health study. This refers to something referred to called the Love Canal Follow-Up Study. This is a study that was started in 1998 and completed 10 years later, about 2008. And the study began 20 years after the first evacuation of the community at Love Canal. The funds to pay for this study came from a $3 million settlement between the U.S. government and Occidental Petroleum, the responsible party to dump the chemical waste at Love Canal. A technical advisory committee that I sat on that consisted mostly of Love Canal veterans, scientists initially, almost only scientists initially, was put together, but this advisory committee was put together after the study design had already been selected and after all the decisions had been made about how to move forward. So this committee was really just a token in terms of its ability to influence what was being done. Early on, this study failed to involve any residents. Actually, at no point did the study involve any residents in the study design, and the study design only computer registries. So what they did in this particular case is look at cancer, mortality, and reproductive outcomes, birth defects, miscarriages, birth weight, and so on, all available from databases. And why did they do this? Because that was the only way they could get the study done. The residents of Love Canal weren't interested in participating in anything done by the state of New York, and so the state had no choice in this case but to kind of use this. But what's happened is this has become the model for how to do health studies in communities, is looking at these kinds of databases, looking at the aggregate statistics in specific areas like zip codes or census tracts. So what are some of the limitations of doing this? Moving on to the next slide. In the case of cancer, 25% of the former residents of Love Canal had moved out of the state. So none of the cancers of people in this group were recorded, included in this study. That's a huge problem, 25% leaving the state. With regard to birth defects, the registry did not begin until 1983. So any birth defects that occurred prior to this time, and the whole neighborhood was evacuated in 1980, so all the birth defects that occurred while people lived at Love Canal were not included in this analysis. So those are huge limitations in the ability to determine whether the health problems that are occurring or what health problems are occurring in this population. So why did DOH do this? Why did they go this way? I mentioned that you know, nobody would participate in the study. But what they did, and what they told me repeatedly when I raised this question with them, is they did what they could do. This was a kind of study that they could do. So they had to respond, they had to have a way of responding to the questions being raised. And in this case, the money that was set aside by the lawsuit was required, somebody had to do a study. So this is what the state could do. But what they did by doing it this way is they provide answers to the questions that nobody cared about. They provide information on statistics that was not important to the people who once lived at Love Canal, to the former residents. And this leads to what I refer to as lamppost epidemiology. And there's an image on the next slide of this lamppost epidemiology. And what you see there is a person who lost his keys. And instead of looking where he might have lost them by his car, he's looking under the lamppost because he can see. And there's light there. And so this is the analogy to what's happening in these kinds of studies, where scientists do what they can do, but it isn't where the problem is, and they're not answering the questions that people have. And this is very frustrating. So in the next slide, so what I have here is just some examples of how public health agencies do not have the data on some or all the health problems in a community, and they do not have the data at the level of the community, so they go forward. I've already mentioned that. So moving on to the next slide, this approach leads us down a strange path that results in many of the following responses by public health agencies. So they end up doing health studies and investigations that are not responsive to community needs. They ignore the assumptions and limitations that underlie the studies and their decisions in doing these studies. They use statistical significant testing to deny causal relationships that may exist, but statistically they're not able to distinguish them. Like in the Wagner Point case, where you have all these increases in lung cancer and cancers in general, but statistically they're not there, so they cannot, you know, say that they're statistically significant. And they deny links between toxic substances in the environment and disease, all because their study, as limited as it is, which are, again, these assumptions are, and limitations are ignored, but they deny the relationship between toxic substances and the environment and diseases. And ultimately, they end up assuming exposures are safe until proven otherwise. Of course, none of this is any good. None of this from a community perspective. And while it's not true for every public health official or environmental official, it still rings very true in many situations. And after years of grappling with this issue, I've come to recognize that there's a fundamental problem that leads to so many of these government responses. And that is, as scientists, we simply don't have the scientific methods that can answer the questions that people have about health problems in their community with any accuracy or assurance. That we cannot tell what's causing an increase in cancer, birth defects, or any other adverse effect in a population of people. And I want to repeat that, because that is the gist of my message today. we don't have the scientific methods that can tell us what's causing an increase in cancer, birth defects, or any other adverse effects in a population of polite people. I believe this issue leads to many of the other problems that community leaders have with public health officials, and it's why it's so difficult to answer the questions that community leaders raise. So in summary and conclusion, on the last slide, I have four conclusions that I'd like to point to. And these are, first, the best scientific methods are not adequate to provide answers to people's questions about health problems in their community. Second, we need to stop doing the same old in terms of health studies and thinking that the results will be different. We need to acknowledge that the limitations of the best scientific methods and what they can accomplish and look to find new ways to respond to the concerns and questions raised by communities about chemical exposure. And lastly, you as a community need to ask if the proposed health study can answer your basic questions about health problems observed in your community and to help you achieve your organization's goals. So I'm going to stop there. We can now open things up to Q&A. I'll be happy to answer questions, talk any more about any of this. Those of you who want to ask questions, you should unmute your line by hitting *6. If you would ask your question and then hit *6 again, that would be great so we minimize background noise. So, does anybody want to start?
Hi, this is Wendy. Hi, Steven?
Yes, what was your name?
My name is Elise Rome. I'm calling from Seattle. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Very helpful. I represent a group in Southern California. We've discovered a serious disease and cancer cluster, and we're just getting the basic information on what our plans, what we're going to be doing. I have a question about your last conclusion, basically the problem, that we don't have the scientific methods that can tell us what's causing an increase in cancer. I want to know, why not? To me, it seems like there's so many brilliant minds in this world. what's causing that problem? Can you describe that more?
It's a very good question. I think there's a number of aspects to it in terms of the answer. And one is that when Love Canal was happening 30 years ago, the standard for doing a health study was to go door to door and knock and with a survey questionnaire and ask the people who are directly affected what their health problems are. And as part of that analysis, people would define who the exposed population is. So you would end up with a group of people, a cohort, if you will, a group of people who've been exposed, and then you'd evaluate what their health problems were. When you do that traditional epidemiological method, that can give you, depending on how many people are involved, again, that's a statistical question, but in many places, in many communities, this is what they did initially at Love Canal and at Times Beach, Missouri, and at many other places back in the early, in the mid-1970s and into the early 80s. But what the agencies found when they did these kind of analysis is that it took a great deal of time and cost a great deal of money. And these kinds of problems were popping up everywhere. When Love Canal was kind of an isolated situation, at least in terms of public awareness, government said, okay, we can do this. But when Love Canal started popping up all over the country, hundreds of sites like this, thousands over the next few years, then the government realized they can't do this. They can't afford it. It's cost prohibitive. So they eliminated the fundamental epidemiological study, the traditional, more traditional studies. And those studies have found some health outcomes, adverse health outcomes related to populations, particularly in workplace exposures and in a few community exposures as well. So they've moved to these other more convenient but less sensitive measures, and those are the ones that I'm really referring to as being the less sensitive measures.
Okay. Okay, I understand. I thought you meant that there actually was no study that could be done. But you're saying We do have those methods, but the government doesn't want to put the time or money into it, and they'd rather do these other studies, which conveniently are not going to find anything, and it's going to limit their liability. That's what it sounds like to me. There's just, and you know, looking at it realistically, I think that there's so much environmental contamination across our nation now that the government would not have the money or the time to be able to adequately address all of that. And so we're left with this conundrum.
Right. Now, let me just clarify one other thing. I mean, the traditional epidemiological method has its set of limitations. I mean, those aren't ideal. So
okay.
It's not like you can do those, and the chances are good that you'll find help out. There are many problems with those as well. Some of those problems moved away as well. Those are the reasons they would give you. They would talk about the cost, so they might cost you talk about the time. You know, there are many reasons aren't very good. So in the entire universe of metals have lots of limitations. And so I want people to recognize that this is the universe, this is the resources that are used to evaluate these studies. And none of them are very good. So you really begin to ask yourselves whether the questions you have can be answered by these tools, and then think about whether that's what's going to help you advance what you're trying to accomplish in your communities.
All right. I will sign off here and let somebody else speak. Thank you.
Okay.
Hi. This is Lockie Seward in Buckingham, Virginia. And we're the site of the only proposed compressor station for the pipeline. And right now the company that is proposing that pipeline is planning to use the health study provided by FERC, which is in fact one of the studies that you talked about that finds no significance for methane, benzene, all of the other VOCs, the radon, and so forth, at this one of the largest proposed compressor stations in the country. So my question to you is, we have gone, you know, door to door in the community most impacted, but that has made no difference because this presumed federal study, supersedes, and again, the company itself is using that against us. So I guess from a preventive perspective, what would be your recommendation to the local officials who have to approve or disapprove a special use permit for this heavy industrial facility on the basis of its health impact?
There's a lot of back chatter, so if anybody is responsible, please mute your phone. We should talk more about this after this call, but let me say this now, and that is the thing you want to do is basically what I call a preemptive strike. You want to have somebody evaluate this study, look at this study design, and basically predict what the study is going to say based on its limitations. So if it's truly using one of these health studies review or looking at census data or zip code data, there's almost no way to determine because you have so many people, you have your statistics of the impact of people diluted by other people who aren't being exposed to the same degree. So you'll never find really what the impact might be. But I'm not sure I understand what kind of health study they're doing at all. Because you don't have any exposure yet. Can you comment on that?
Sorry, I had to unmute my line. I'm sorry. I was trying to help. Yes, this is supposedly a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission website, on their website, and I haven't had a chance to look at it because I just heard that that's what the corporation that intends to build this compressor station will be using. So I am in public health, so I will look at it and read it with all of your points, thankfully, in mind. So I do believe it's zip code based. I'm not sure exactly yet. I just needed to get on this call. So I will definitely do that. But it is sort of the company's preemptive strike against the door-to-door work that we have already done. We went door-to-door to meet all the people and find out baseline medical conditions that would be exacerbated by the huge amounts of emissions for, you know, the only compressor station in a huge number of miles. So anyway, so the idea is just what tools to use to kind of preempt their use of a of one of these methods, aggregate, you know, where the statistical significance disappears.
Right, right. So two comments about this. Personal comments. One is that you're doing your own survey. We would call that a health industry. And we've written about that and
right.
You know, talk about this and we can give you some samples of even some of the questions you might want to ask. Because you're already doing the right thing. If this thing gets to get built, then you can begin to continue to track the adverse health problems that are occurring. And you can show that it's having an impact. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I'm working with a group now in the District of Columbia, in the city of Washington, D.C., where they want to build a hospital. And the city is sitting on a health impact assessment.
Yeah.
And they census track zip centric evaluation of health problems on the city. And everybody waited for this study to complete. And it's done by zip code, and all of the impacted neighborhoods immediately adjacent to where, and this where this soccer field was proposed on old contaminated soil that were in the field part of the field. So everybody's waited for this health assessment to be done, and it tells nobody anything because it's so diluted by so many people who are not impacted by this property being included. They don't find any adverse outcomes now before the project begins, which is not surprising. And so I don't know what their FERC study, but I'm guessing that it's just a diversionary by FERC to government officials to think this to tell somebody something about the risk that this facility or this gas compressor will on the community. And it won't. It won't say anything, especially if it's done by zip code that will include so many people who won't be impacted. And so part of what you can do in addition is to have prior to the out where you highlight and predict what the outcome is going to be. I've done this, and this is something we can talk more about in terms of how you might go about doing it.
Thank you.
So I have a question.
This is Jewel Crawford. Can you hear me?
Yep.
And my question is, why can't you draw conclusions based on the weight of evidence? In other words, if you have a chemical, you know the toxic effects of the chemical, you know the adverse health effects, say it's a cancer, and then you have a cancer cluster, I mean, why can't you correlate those things and at least draw some conclusions based on the correlations and the weight of evidence, and at least let people know that there is a relationship here, a very strong relationship, and draw conclusions based on that when you have a cancer cluster?
Yeah, that's a very, very good comment. Weight of evidence, again, what used to be used years ago by government agencies, and it involves judgment. That's one of the reasons why it's fallen out of favor. Government instead has moved to something called risk assessment, which I suspect you're familiar with, probably most of our listeners are familiar with. Risk assessment is considered to be more scientific, quote-unquote. And these other statistical methods are considered to be more scientific because you don't have to use judgment. And there's nothing wrong with it. Weight of evidence and relying on expert judgment is not a bad way to go, but you end up in a very debatable place. Not that using risk assessment doesn't also put you in a debatable place, but the arena is more controllable in the risk assessment place because all the people arguing tend to be experts, and the community is kind of limited in their capacity and ability in those kind of controversies. So you're right, it's a great suggestion. We could use weight of evidence much more in evaluating these things. Could be doing that much more often than they do. But they've fallen out of favor with using instead go to a risk assessment approach. And you know, my favorite perception of risk assessment is what I decide is acceptable for you, or what government decides is acceptable for a community. The people who are impacted rarely, if ever, are asked to participate in the process of evaluating what's acceptable, what the is that's used to determine whether it's cleaning up a contaminated site or a level of contaminated benzene in somebody's air. You know, the experts are always the ones who decide that, and they're not the ones who have to bear the risk. And all the assumptions that have to go into that process are just that, assumptions. So I could talk for hours about risk. I don't want to go there. But
I just want to say that we need to have a task force of trained university people that can go toe-to-toe with government and industry, because government and industry are in cahoots with each other. That's all there is to it. And there need to be university-level professors, you know, at our schools that can contest what the government and industry are saying about these things.
I agree. I mean, that kind of thing would be very valuable. And there are some people in the university world, the folks at BU, Madeline Scammell, and some others at different universities, I think fit that bill to what extent they...
Wilmer Tubra.
Yeah, there are some folks out there, that's right. So, I mean, there are folks there, so the idea is there needs to be more of an organized effort to try to address these limitations and to get government to move away from using these. And you know, my best efforts have fallen on lots of deaf ears because I'm one voice. You know, this all goes back to the concept of, you know, organizing and you know, you can have the best ideas in the world, but if you're one voice, if it's really different from what the norm is, people won't go there. You know, the government is very comfortable with the risk assessment process and using these new methods, not really new, but these computer database analyses, because that's how they can appear to be responsive to community concerns without actually answering people's questions.
Yeah, because the government is political and influenced by the lobbyists.
Yeah. I know, probably
sound
cynical and
strange. Yes, I'll stop now and let someone else ask a question, but thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Susan. This is Joan from Waycross, Georgia. How are you?
Great. How are you?
We already have an ASTDR evaluation going on, and we actually got blocked from the process of being able to even review how they were planning on evaluating anything. I mean, do you have any suggestions on how to overcome that problem?
So they wouldn't even give you the opportunity to comment on the same time? We're having some background noise. Whoever might use their phone, that would be great. So Joan asked, when ATSDR blocked her from participating, are there any suggestions on how to address that? And the only way I know you can force an agency like that to give you more input into study design or study analysis is by having a strong community group that has presence in a community and that is not, if it is backed by the community or a good portion of the community. As an individual, if you complain about not being able to get into a study design or review a study design, they tend to ignore you, which it sounds like what they did. But if your community is and your organization is stronger and has the power of community support behind it, then it's harder for them to ignore you.
Okay.
I know that's not easy to achieve, but it's often the only way I've known that people can get ATSD or any agency for that matter who's doing a health study to really do pay attention to them. It's
okay.
About the political pressure you can raise. And part of that is being in the media.
Right.
Being a presence in the media.
Okay, I've got one more question. So, in these problems, is it easier to identify or use any of these existing methods when it is an actual, like, known release that happens and there's a starting point versus something that's happened over decades? Do you know what I'm trying to say, ask here?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's obviously a lot easier to evaluate a plume that's been released from a plant and looking at its impacts. But when you've had a slow release from contaminated soil over many, many years, tens years, 20 years, 30 years, decades, it's much harder. The exposure side of this equation, and the equation being what's the health outcome from an exposure, the exposure side is always the hardest to get at. You know, you can go out and measure people's, you know, rates of cancer or the number of people in your neighborhood who have reproductive problems or kidney disease or whatever. That you can measure kind of relatively easily. But trying to determine what they were exposed to or what common exposure exists in a community or a population of people, that's a much tougher thing to do. And there's no real easy way to do that. The lady who talked about weight of evidence, you know, that's what one could do is look at soil data, air data, history information, historical information in terms of what dumping may have occurred, maybe body burden levels in some instances, blood work or something like that. You know, you can build a case of trying to create a picture of what exposure might have occurred in a community that might be common to the people that have all these health problems. But it's the toughest piece, and the most assumptions go into that side of the equation from the so-called expert side than from the health side.
So like in ours, we've been at this for like 3 or 4 years trying to figure out why all of our children are getting these cancers. But we finally have narrowed down. We have polonium-210 that's in the water, and it looks as if it started. We've got some good markers that show that the growth alpha started jumping when they started injecting bacteria into the aquifer to clean up an existing site. And the bacteria causes the polonium to release sediment and get up into the water column. So I think
you're kind of on the track of weight of evidence. I mean, I think that's the kind of you almost have to be an exposure detective, you know, an investigative detective of sorts, because the government won't do this kind of work, and you're left as a community person to try to create these kind of pictures of what may be going on. And it sounds like you're putting pieces together, and that's a useful thing. But at the same time, you also need to be, you know, communicating with your community and building your community organization, because once, even if you were to get a pretty good picture, if the weight of your community isn't behind what you're showing the government, they may not pay any attention to you. I don't know, but I've seen it happen in past situations.
What about
do you have examples of how to show that in a report? Is there a resource you would recommend for those of us who do have a lot of weight of evidence? I'm sorry, I'm in Oklahoma.
Not really. I'd have to research that. I think there are some examples of weight of evidence. I'll have to research that, see if I can't give you some examples. Because it goes back literally to the 1970s. That's when that was used, that standard for evaluating risks for the public. You know, all kinds of risks. So I'll see if I can find something that I could share. Okay. Any other questions? Others?
Hi, this is Laura from Wisconsin. Is there anything being done, or what could we do in terms of policy change in how these assessments are done, or a change in the standard that's been set for these inconclusive studies?
I think it would take a very focused national effort that would basically come from the ground up, from communities like the people on this call, who say that these tools don't work. We need better tools. We need to think about this in a more holistic way. You know, policy, you know, it would take an enormous amount of work. But I think it could be done, and I think that there's a, you know, it would be a wonderful campaign for an organization to take on, to try to address the tools for evaluating health problems in communities.
Because one place to start is, if a lot of communities are doing this work, is even finding a, creating a common place on the CHEJ website where you could post these, and the collective impact of that might be a way to generate interest from decision makers.
Right, right.
And then people can see what other studies look like, how it was presented. But and then you could, at the same time, I think your point at the beginning of the discussion about a health study will never create a win. But it is an important tool that's part of a greater campaign.
Right.
But by itself, and I agree with you that media and organizing your community is what's going to get political support, which is the beginning of a win.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. Those are just my thoughts. I appreciate the call very much.
Okay. Yeah, I can't agree with you more. I mean, it's, you know, as I said years ago, we would actually tell people, don't bother. I mean, don't do the study. It's a waste of your energy, your time, because the results will be inconclusive. But people are driven by the health problems in their community. It's the most important, in some ways, it's the most important piece of why people are involved. And so it's hard to ignore. But I don't really want to say one should ignore it. It's one needs to place it in context. And you need to look at and understand the limitations of these tools. And so it's really more about understanding limitations and realizing that you may get more, you may achieve more as a community organization by strengthening your community group and finding ways to put pressure on the decision makers so you achieve what you're trying to accomplish in your community. And eventually, maybe you can get a more focused study that more addresses the questions you have. But again, how you can achieve that is if you can sit at the table. You'll never be equal to ATSDR in terms of their resources and their abilities to evaluate health studies. But if you're sitting at the table representing a community that's one, or many pieces of the community, many parts of the community are one, then they have to take you seriously. And then you can have input on the study, and then you can have you could even convince them to give you money to hire a scientist, somebody who can be a participant with them, with the government agency. I mean, we tried years ago to get ATSDR to pass something that we called HAGS, Health Assessment Grants. Some of you may be familiar with TAGS, Technical Assistance Grants. This is money that's provided to every community group that at a Superfund site that applies for this money, $50,000 per Superfund site. And we met with the highest, you know, the director of ATSDR 5 or 6 years ago and said, why not make tags available? You know, maybe it's not $50,000, maybe it's $20,000. And at one point, $1 million was set aside in the ATSDR budget for hags. But it was eliminated because of the political, you know, the political people who are not at the ATSDR, but other people who review budgets and things like that in Congress said, that's crazy. We can't give communities access to scientists so they can do health studies. I mean, again, that goes back to somebody's comment about the political side of this and the corporate influence on government and the politicians. But, I mean, you know, but how you have influence and how you can get a study that would be more meaningful is by having a stronger group that's clear on what you want and is representative of your community, and the government knows it. We have any more questions? I think we have time for one or two more or comments.
Yes, this is Kimberly Flynn from New York City. And by the way, I'm so grateful for the information on this call. If we had had a call like this, you know, in 2002, 2003, it would have, you know, done wonders for those of us who were organizing the Lower Manhattan community in the struggle with EPA over, you know, all of the toxic substances that were deposited inside of residential and office buildings in Lower Manhattan through the 9/11 attacks. So one thing that I do want to comment on is this issue of the weight of evidence, preponderance of evidence, and I just want to make everyone aware of a very important instance of using this approach to get coverage for cancers that are attributed to 9/11 exposures, you know, outside of any kind of epidemiological framework. So the argument that was made by a scientific and technical advisory committee that came together to look at what conditions, you know, the federal government would provide coverage for conditions that could be attributed to 9/11 exposures, decided in essence that an epidemiologic approach was inappropriate because the information would arrive too late. And all of the firefighter families who lost their primary firefighter breadwinner because he participated in rescue and recovery after the World Trade Center attack, you know, the house would be double mortgaged, the kids' college fund would be spent on healthcare, right? And it would be basically a rolling disaster. So the approach that was taken was to look at IARC studies and to look at the studies, the analysis of the National Toxicology Program. So it's IARC, it's the, what is it, the International Agency for Research on Cancers, and it's the National Toxicology Program. What they have basically done is created a many decades-long review process, and they review all of the scientific evidence surrounding cancer impacts for individual carcinogens, and they make a judgment, right? And I maybe Stephen, please correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong. I'm trying to condense all of this, but basically, they make a judgment about the level of carcinogenicity of these individual substances, and they also look at the list of cancers that are, you know, scientifically associated with these substances. So to use a simple example, right, you have asbestos and then you have mesothelioma. You have benzene and you have, you know, a host of blood cancers, right? So here's how they did the work. The Scientific Technical Advisory Committee looked at it. Yeah.
Because we need to wrap up, okay?
Okay, sure. I'm just going to point this out as a resource. So look at IARC and look at the cancers that are caused by the chemicals that IARC reviewed and use that to make an argument because this is a pre-existing body of evidence.
Yeah, that's a very good example.
Than epidemiology.
it's at a different level in some ways because you have the leading research scientists, cancer scientists in the world getting together to make those judgments. And so it's really a very unique group, but it's a resource that one could draw upon to make arguments. So that's a great suggestion. But we need to wrap up now. We're at our limit of time. It's 1 o'clock, and we're trying to hold to our time and not keep people longer than we said we would. So I want to thank everybody. Uni, do you have any closing thoughts or words, or do you want me to wrap up?
Nothing really. I think there was a lot of great discussion. I think for the future, for future calls, I guess maybe for my own reference, but if anyone does, you know, if you want to call in and ask a question in the future, if you could maybe take your phone off of speaker, because I noticed, you know, we had a period where there was quite a lot of feedback, and it was only Stephen and the other speaker. So just keeping that in mind, but otherwise I think there was a lot of, you know, insightful discussion, and we should have the recording up soon.
Okay, and we will follow up. We'll send up everybody a follow-up. There will be the survey, which will come out shortly,
right.
And then in addition to that, there will be another follow-up where we'll send the BU link and the Truth and Consequences paper to everybody. So thank you all for participating. We have these calls every month, third Tuesday of the month. The next call will feature Lois Gibbs, our organizing director. Not sure the topic, but we will sure to let you know. Shortly, in anticipation of that call. Thank you all again. Bye-bye.